Focus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falzon Historic House Museum entitled Edward Lear, The Exhibition. This talk is delivered by Professor John Variano.
We're here because of the Edward Lear lecture, which is the first event in the program of events relating to the exhibition which opened an hour ago at Palazzo Falzon. It will run till the 4th January. For those of you who haven't been yet, I know that a few of you actually managed to go and see it. It is within Palazzo Falzon itself. It's the fourth in our series of temporary exhibitions at Palazzo Falzon. We started with exhibitions dedicated to very little known areas of the decorative arts. We started with an exhibition on whistles years ago, and then we had one on smoking pipes. We then had another one on scent bottles, and now we have one, in this case, relating to the fine arts, about Edward Lear's time in Malta and Gozo. Of course, John will be explaining all about that. John has very kindly accepted to guest curate this exhibition. I'll be introducing him as we go along. But I also want to tell you that there are other events planned in this program of events. We're going to have gallery talks for the public as well. So you'll be hearing about them as we go along. We generally advise you about these events about 2 weeks in advance by email. In fact, Jean will be sending around a form where you can fill in your email details in case you're not on our list yet. We're also going to have a children's workshop where we combine Lear's literary production, if you like, with his doodles, which are fantastic, and I think John will be showing us some of them. And they were actually written and produced for children. So we're going to revisit that theme and get children to be inspired by this aspect of Lear's life. We're also going to have we're holding an artist's masterclass. It's basically for people who paint or draw, or at least have an idea of drawing or painting. It will be held next Saturday, and what we are doing is we are going to follow in Lear's footsteps. We're going to go to the different sites where he painted in our landscape, mostly in the north of Malta, and together with John Martin Borch, who is a very established watercolorist, and we will see a number of demonstrations by John Martin Borch, but also try and put ourselves in his shoes, in Edward Lear's shoes, and try to paint bearing his technique in mind. So it's a way of getting to know Edward Lear and painting sort of inspired by his style. Of course, everybody has their own style. So that's going to be great fun, and it's next week on Saturday. We're going to spend the whole day together traveling around these different spots and painting. Right, I'll now pass over to John. That this is, of course, the whole point of... I'm not seeing John, actually. Ah, there you are. Okay. I'm sorry, I've been spinning this out at great length because I wasn't seeing John. Okay. Of course, Professor Variano needs no introduction. He's been to Malta on several occasions, and in recent years, he has always kindly volunteered to give public lectures about the various areas of academic research which he has excelled in and which he has published, including food and wine in relation to art as displayed in art, Caravaggio, had lecture on Caravaggio, but also Lear. Lear is a perhaps more recent interest of yours academically, but he has taken it so far as to guest curate our exhibition and to publish a book which will hit our bookstores in the next few days, but we do have a sample copy at the back of the hall so you can go through it. John, without further ado, I'll pass over to you.
It's a great pleasure, of course, to be here at the inauguration of this beautiful exhibition and to be here at the moment in Palazzo Santa Sofia. And I think there's a wonderful symmetry to all of this in my research on Lear. It began in Palazzo Falzon in February of 2012. And Francesca was giving me a tour of the collection. We looked at everything downstairs. We went upstairs. And right towards the end of this visit, I saw this ravishing watercolor. And I thought it was the most beautiful Lear watercolor I may have ever seen. I said, that's Malta? And she said, yes, yes, that's Malta. So I immediately did some bibliographical searching about, and I found that there was no books or comprehensive studies of Lear in Malta, no catalogs of his work. And it's one of those moments I just decided, this is my next project. And this results in the exhibition that is across the street, and the book which will be available in just a few days, maybe even a matter of hours. And if I can get the technology working. Now, some of you who were here back in February, were any of you here in February?
Yes.
Well, you were. Okay, because what I was going to do this morning is to repeat some of the things which I said in that February talk by way of an introduction. And for those of you who have already heard this, it may seem a bit déjà entendu, but this is what we were talking about in February, which I'll try to condense a bit, and then move on to ideas about the exhibition itself. Now, the new revelations that I was talking about, and which made this whole project possible, really had to do more with the materials that had become, in the last 10 years, available on the internet. And one of the sets of materials that became available in 2012, after my harassing people at the Houghton Library at Harvard, was to digitize, to scan and digitize the 30 volumes of Lear's diaries. He wrote 60 volumes. The first 30 have not survived. But the diaries of Edward Lear, should anybody be interested in pursuing Lear and his travels and so on, was they're kept at the Houghton from 1858 until his death in 1888. And after I tried to transcribe some of this stuff in the Houghton Library, it gave me an enormous headache. Very difficult to transcribe English to English, and in typing up these transcriptions, I think that was the bulk of the work. Someone asked me yesterday what was the most difficult part of this project. It was probably transcribing English to English, because Lear had this very crabbed Victorian hand, and there's so much about Lear and about his life in the diaries. I'll show you one page rather quickly. You have always the date at the top. The first few words always tell you what time that morning he arose. It will then go on to tell you what he had for breakfast. It will also, very prominently, usually up at the top, tell you what the weather conditions were like that day. If it was pouring rain, he didn't go out very much. He worked at home. There are also here, generally every single one of these pages, talks about his itinerary if he was traveling around the island and how he traveled around the island. And if he took a carriage, what he paid for the carriage. Edward Lear was what you would nowadays call OCD. He had to just meticulously record everything in his life that was going on. Now, in terms of Lear's living in Malta, he often included, most days, a little sketch at the bottom of the page, which shows the shape, and it's not always circular, sometimes it's rectangular, the shape of the table at which he dined, and the names of the people he dined with. And this makes it very easy to determine who he saw in Malta, who he talked to in Malta, and also who he did not talk to in Malta. And there are some real surprises about who he did not talk to in Malta. And these are some of the things that one kind of integrate into her study of Lear on the island. And then the other thing I should point out is down on some of these pages, about one-third of the pages, there's a little designation with an X or two X's or more, and then a number in parentheses. That refers to the epileptic seizures that Lear experienced. Now, he was not a healthy individual. He had arthritis. He had bronchial problems, asthma, problems with his eyesight, at one early stage of his life, and please don't ask me any questions about this afterwards, he records in a letter of his own that he contracted syphilis. If you read all his diaries and all of his letters, it's kind of hard to figure out where he would or how he would have contracted syphilis. But he admits it in a letter to someone. Now, the early literature, this is a little bit of historiography, the early literature on Edward Lear is entirely dependent upon two books that were published in 1907 and 1911, Letters of Edward Lear. First is called Letters of Edward Lear, and the second volume in 1911 is called Later Letters of Edward Lear. And in some of those letters, there are glimpses, he writes to people, and he wrote to one person, and he said he had syphilis, he had this, he had that. You get a little bit of a sense of what, to any extent, you might consider to be his romantic life. Complicated issue. Remember, this is Victorian times, not 21st century, and mores and interaction between sexes are very different. And it's the one era, in fact, where Lear is very private, about the only era in which he's very private. Also, at the back of every one of these diaries is an account book of every expense, every tiny expense he made in the course of a year. And there are, we're in the month of December. He arrived in Malta December of 1865, and he would record what he paid for what, the porter's fees. I put an arrow here, ticket to Malta. He was coming from Marseille. It was 10 pounds, other things you see in here, maps. On the 26th of January, he bought two maps of Malta and Gozo at Muir's bookstore. And you can sort of assemble a biography in ways for using these primary sources. And I think the real contribution of this exhibition is that it is the first exhibition, to my knowledge, where the diary entries, which have only been made available since 2012, unless you had months and months and months to spend in Cambridge, Massachusetts, transcribing this stuff. Since 2012, it's now anyone can check any of these. All you need is a laptop. So that's the first of the revelations that made this project possible. The second of the revelations, also having to do with the computer, is the fact that many museums in the world have websites with their collection databases. Auction houses have their databases, both of works coming up for sale and works sold in the past in their archives. And there's also this wonderful device called ArtNet, which you can, anyone is free to look at it, and you can trace the sale of any work of art by any artist. I think it goes back, to 1989. And if you pay a subscription fee, which some museums and serious collectors do, and if you are a serious collector, I recommend you doing that, you pay a subscription fee, and it will tell you what each work of art sold for, what the hammer price was. It's usually auctions, not so much private dealers. So the combination of things, like the website of the Yale Center for British Art, which owns 12 watercolors of Lear in Malta, the ArtNet, which shows 35 views of Malta sold since 1989, and finally, good old Google Images. If you go to Google Images, you type in almost anything, you know, up come all these images. So the collection of images, for my part, was very dependent on these resources. Not that the museum sites are always very complete. It's astonishing how some of the great museums of the world do not have collection databases, and you still have to, the old-fashioned method of writing a letter and hoping you might get a response. So these are the two elements that contribute to the study. Now, also, I just want to point out briefly, because we go on for quite a while, talking about Edward Lear as a man of many talents. His career begins as an illustrator of books of natural history, especially birds. And I'm told that Lear's depiction of birds is the first description, illustrative descriptions of birds that was painted from real life. that later illustrations, ornithological illustrations of this kind, were made from dead stuffed birds. So, I mean, this is a contribution of his own. Among ornithologists, if you said the name of Lear, they said, oh yeah, he's the guy that did all the birds. And they're astonishingly beautiful, these birds. He also, the second item, nonsense poetry. I've really been amused in over the last couple of years when people ask me what I'm working on or what I'm doing or why I'm always going to Malta. I say, I'm looking at his drawings and his watercolors and so on. But people who have heard of Lear, try this on your own. You say, oh, I went to this lecture on Lear this morning. They're likely to say, oh, is he the guy who wrote The Owl and the Pussycat? Is he the guy that wrote all those little quatrains that later became known as limericks? You know, there was a man from Leeds who swallowed a packet of seeds, that kind of thing. That's where his reputation, even in his lifetime, but as you get into the 20th century, really was fixed. Although, let me point out that Lear himself, in his letters and in the diary, thinks of himself only as a painter. The underline is only as a painter. These nonsense poems and so forth are really just a little divertimento, a little marginalia, and they often appear at the bottom of a letter, or they appear in some place that he probably didn't imagine that they would be seen, although they were, even in his lifetime, collected and published together in anthologies of nonsense verse. Lear also did 6 travel books. Now, these diaries, I suspect, he was keeping in part so as to be able, when he was back in the cold, rainy London, the city he called Fogopolis, when he was back in Fogopolis, he could transcribe these diaries into what he calls journals. Now, a journal is nothing more than a really cleaned up version of the diary, in which all personal references and all the irritations he constantly felt. Lear is one of the most irritable human beings I think I've ever worked on. The last big project I did on a painter was Caravaggio, who was also, you could say, pretty irritable and constantly misperceiving slights and violations of his honor. Lear published 6 travel books based on the counts that he himself culled from his own diary. And these were appeared mainly in his lifetime. A few of them appeared after his lifetime. I'm happy to say that Lear in Malta and this book, which I'm sure you're all going to want to buy and give away as Christmas presents, is the last place that Lear went, which does not already have a catalog, a monograph, or some independent study. Lear in Malta was like the new frontier, the last frontier for Lear's studies. Now, below that, of course, with oil paintings, he would have himself thought primarily in terms of oil painting. That's the big ambition. But he would only do oil paintings on commission. He would not paint them and then try to sell them through a dealer or a gallery. Thousands of watercolors. It's estimated that there were 7,000 watercolors that Lear painted during his lifetime. Now, I'm very fortunate. I live kind of in the remote part in the mountains of western Massachusetts. Within an hour and a half of where I live, if I head east, I'm at the Harvard Library, which has 3,700 Lear watercolors, in addition to the diaries, 3,700. If I drive to the south about an hour and a half at the Yale Center for British Art, they have, I think, 662 Lear watercolors. So all told, within an hour and a half of where I live in the state of Massachusetts, the bulk of Lear's material resides. That is over 4,000 watercolors, what's estimated to be a total of about 7,000. Now, Lear's travels, he was a very peripatetic individual, always on the go, always during the winter months, I must say, really did not like London. And he came to places in the Mediterranean, the southern world, the Aegean, the Ionian. He went to Middle Eastern countries and so forth. This is a list of some of the modern countries. I wish I could say this is Lear's passport. It's not. It's a typical Victorian era passport with stamps in it and so forth. Now, we get to Malta itself. he made 7 or 8 trips to Malta, and Malta was, throughout the 19th and the 20th century, the stopping off point for anyone from Northern or Central Europe headed into the Mediterranean, going to Greece, going to Egypt. You would have to change boats, take on water and what have you in Malta. So the first trips, the first 5 trips were stopovers, which lasted, I think, at most 2 days, or 1 night and 2 days. 1862, he was here for 10 days because he didn't like shipping arrangements to leave earlier, so he stayed for 10 days, walked around, loved the island, vowed to come back. It did take him a few years to do so, but in 1865, December, he returned to Malta, and he decided to spend the winter on the island. Very good idea, which I've tried myself, and it works. Now, of the visual material, which is, I think, what probably everyone came to see and hear about, the earliest surviving Maltese watercolor is this one on your left. And it shows Benjema from a distance. It was sold in London at auction 2011. I have no idea where it is now. It might be in a private collection even in Malta, where the interest in collecting Maltese lires is very strong. I really have no idea where it might be. And then in the exhibition, and incidentally, all these images, when it's preceded by an asterisk, means the work is in the exhibition at Palazzo Falzon. If it doesn't have an asterisk, it means it's somewhere else. And I've tried sometimes to put down where that location is. In 1862, when he had the 10 days here, he was completely struck by the Grand Harbor. He was staying at a hotel in Valletta, so it wasn't so tricky for him to go to the Baraka Point. He loved Baraka. Some of his most poetic descriptions of a place, an evocation of the feeling of a place, is Lear standing in the Baraka Gardens, and of course I've had to go there and find the very bench, I believe, he was sitting on when he did these two views. And this is the earliest watercolor in the exhibition. And note, please, in 1862 and other visits, he did not number the watercolors sequentially, which he did on his longest visit, which is what makes the collection of this material and seeing it in a kind of chronological order so easy to do. And so that's Singlet A and B here. That's in the exhibition. Now, when he arrived in December, immediately he started looking for housing, and he looked at several places which he didn't think were quite right. He was looking for places that had a view, that had some privacy, that had a room for studio, room for him. He always traveled with a servant, Giorgio Coccali, and he found such a house at 9 Via Torre in Sliema. It's a decision he came to regret, but initially he was quite happy, this house in Sliema. And in his diary of the 18th of December, this is just a couple of days after he signed the lease, and in the account book we know what he paid for rent, we know everything, when he furnished the house. He liked to drink Marsala after dinner. He's buying cases and cases of Marsala, having it delivered to 9 Via Torre. In the diary, he gives a ground plan of the building, the lower floor and the upper floor. You notice there's a balcony here. And the other thing I'll point out, while we had this image on the screen, there's a room which he calls a gallery. And the importance of that will be evident in just a moment. Now, Sliema, at the time Lear lived there, the Strand was a much narrower piece of land. And from one of his windows or balconies, and this is the Lear house right here, it didn't have that far to look across. I would see Manuel Island on one side and all the way to Valletta on the other. Of course, if you know the history of Sliema, when the Strand was expanded and the width increased and the traffic, of course, increased, Lear's house no longer has that viewpoint. And it was a great thrill for me when I first went to this house one evening in February of 2013, I believe, in the company of Catherine Gallia, who had written an undergraduate thesis on Lear in Malta at the university here. And she took me there, and I said, God, and I was looking across the Strand, of course, and I said, that doesn't look like the place Lear would have painted. But happily, I was in the company of Father Marius Zarafa that evening, and he said he remembered, Father Marius remembered what that view of the Strand looked like before this edition. I can't tell you what year the Strand was expanded. If anybody knows, I'm happy to hear. But Father Marius remembers the seawall being back here somewhere. That is right where you see it there. And so Lear's view from his house, or even from his front steps of his house, showed quite a bit. And that's where he really began painting in the 1865 view, one of the early views. Now, these are all, as I mentioned, numbered sequentially, and we can really trace them. The watercolors he did in this period are completely annotated by him, and the image is not so clear here. There are numbers on the lower right-hand corner, always on the lower right-hand corner. This is number 112. There is usually the name of a place, and the way he calls some of these places differs perhaps from the way we would label them. I think one of the challenges we had in the exhibition writing the labels is do we use Lear's spelling, which is very frequently misspelled, or do we use the modern spelling? And kind of went back and forth on that. I'm not absolutely sure. What do we decide is?
On the labels, on
the
that have his spelling.
That have his spelling. Now, also on these watercolors, when you go to the exhibition, you won't see it in these slides, but when you go to the exhibition, use your eyes, you know, put on your reading glasses if you're of the generation that requires reading glasses. Look very closely. There's quite a bit of writing on many of these. And what that writing is are color notations that Lear made on the spot, indicating, you know, what color was the sky, did it have yellow in it, what color was the foreground, and so on. And you can also see that many of these, not all of them, but many of them have the time of day, 6:15 a.m. So that's not a sunset, that's a sunrise with the mist and the atmosphere that we find here in early morning. So these go on and on. While he was in Malta in this period, 65-66, he did approximately 300 watercolors. The last one I was able to find is number 286. But from the diary, we know he did a couple more watercolors, which do not survive, and we have no indication of from any of our other sources. I'm going to guess he probably did about four or five more. So I'm saying it's about 300 watercolors that he painted in the period from late December to March. Now, one of the surprises, there are quite a few of these surprises, one of them is what you find in the diary, that when he came to Malta, the rest of December, all of January, and well into February, he did not paint Malta. He did not draw Malta. He was completing a large painting for an oil commission from Lady Waldegrave back in London of the Grand Canal in Venice. So the first month, 6 weeks of his time in Malta, he was painting Venice. He was also putting the finishing touches upon watercolors that he had begun in Sicily. So he really only began in earnest painting in Malta, beginning number one of 300, in the later part of his stay, and we can see very easily just looking at the dates and the numbers what the sequence was. I think in the month of December he painted 15 watercolors, in the month of January he painted 30, in February he painted 40. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was as we get into the warmer weather and the days are longer, he painted a lot more. So many, many more watercolors from March than there are from January, as you might expect. And this, of course, is the Palazzo Falzon watercolor, which to my eye is still one of the very, very best watercolors that Lear painted on this island. Congratulations to Oliver Gulcher. It was a gift, was it not?
It was a gift from Sir Harry Luke, who was a very good friend.
Sir Harry Luke was the ambassador.
He was Lieutenant Governor of War from the...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So that that's how this got here. And Francesca, by the way, has written a lovely introduction to the museum handout, which talks about early provenance, early collecting history of Malta, collecting history of Lear in Malta. So this is number 76 in the sequence. This notation, by the way, was always done in pencil, and then later in the studio, gone over in ink with a pen. And if you look very carefully, and some of these water, because you really have sharp eyes, you can see the pencil underneath the pen, and he was not always successful in erasing the pencil lines. And you can really track all of this. See, when I said this guy's OCD, I really meant it. I mean, he just really was obsessive about recording detail of this sort. And what's special about this exhibition, I think, is bringing together the diary entry from the day he painted the watercolor itself, March 1st, 66. That's the diary entry from March 1st, 66. And it tells you what the weather was like that day. It was sunshine, if it was warm. Although, as I myself had experienced Malta being here in the winter, one of the biggest obstacles to painting outdoors or doing much anything outdoors is the wind. And he was prevented from going to some sites when he goes to Gozo, which we'll talk about in a few moments. It was very windy when he was there, a week in March. It was windy, he complained that papers were blowing all over the place, and he couldn't really sit down. These are all what we call plein air watercolors, on-site drawings. I use the word drawing in a very specific sense because, as we'll see in a moment, there's a process that he goes through which begins with drawing and ends with painting. Now, initially, when he was here, one of the early ones, number 11, he walked a great deal. Lear was a great walker. And from Sliema, the easiest walk for him was around the bay into St. Julian's Bay. And there's quite a few views of St. Julian's Bay and the water surrounding Sliema. What was disappointing to Lear was, you know, it's sort of ironic, isn't it, that we are sitting here at the time that the big boat race is beginning in Valletta. And I think you came to the right event. I hope you feel that way at the end. Lear really disliked boats. Really disliked boats. And he got seasick, or he thought he was getting seasick. He just was not happy in a boat. And while there was public transportation going from Sliema to Malta, as there's to Valletta, rather, as there still is, he didn't like that boat. He would, when he came to Valletta, he would walk all the way around. He'd much rather do that than spend, 10, 15 minutes in a boat. And so there are quite a few of these, especially in the earlier period, in December, January, where he's painting St. Julian's Bay, or views of Sliema and so forth. This is a late afternoon view, obviously, 5:16, it should probably be about getting dark. And he captures some of the haze of the atmosphere at that time. Now, when the weather got a little bit better and he finally finished the Venice painting, which seemed to take forever, he complains constantly about this thing. It's just such a responsibility and obligation, and I can't wait to finish it, and blah, blah. He begins to then explore the island more, and he almost always goes on foot. And this island is not that small. I don't know if any of you have ever tried to walk across the island, especially walk across it on mid-19th century roads. It's hard enough to drive around the island, as we found out recently. He would take one of these, I assume that's a horse. Is that a horse or a donkey, Bonnie? He would take one of these, and he was so cheap that he always pushed and pushed and negotiated with the driver. Driver said he wanted $5 to go to Città Vecchia or Medina, and Lira said, I'll give you $3. And every one of these journeys started out with an uncomfortable situation. I mean, I would have found it uncomfortable, but Lear always tried to lower the price of anything. And of course, in the account book, you'll find out exactly what each one of those rides cost. The second thing is Lear rarely took the carriage all the way to his destination, like Fourmarie, for example. He didn't take the carriage to Fourmarie. He stopped in Medina, discharged the cab driver, and walked the rest of the way. And he was always with a servant, Giorgio, who carried all of the equipment on his back and lunch. And in the diary, we know every single thing that he ate for lunch. And some of it sounds sort of appetizing, and some of it much less so. And I'm sure Giorgio's also carrying big bottles of water with him. And he's walking from Medina to Fourmarie, and we know exactly from the diary, you know, how that works. Now, in the middle of the century, omnibus service began on this island. There were a couple of services, and he took it only once, and it was to go down from Slema up to the point where the boat leaves for Gozo. And it was kind of an arduous trip. It involved some hills. He was very cranky that another couple and their luggage joined him on this omnibus. And when they got to a hill, Lear was told to get off the bus because the two horses pulling it could not pull the luggage and all of these people together. So he very grumpily writes, I had to walk half the way. You know, I paid for a ticket on the omnibus, but I had to walk. So that was the other way he moved around. But only once did he take an omnibus, and that was on way to Gozo. Now, this is something you really need to pay attention to, and I hope you don't mind if I take the time to read it. This is a first-person eyewitness account of someone who went on these expeditions with Edward Lear. Not to Malta, but he was talking about some other trips. Prior to 1877, this is written by Hubert Congreve. This is an introduction or preface to the letters of Edward Lear, published in the later letters, published in 1911. This is someone who's still alive in 1911, recalling what these trips were like. So we went with him to the studio. We also went on sketching expeditions, following with his assistant George, following behind, laden with lunch and drawing materials. He would lift his when we came to a good subject, Lear would sit down, lift his spectacles, and gaze for several minutes at the scene through a monocular glass. In other words, a kind of like telescope. Then laying down the glass and adjusting his spectacles, he would put on paper the view before us. Mountain range, villages, and foreground, with the rapidity and accuracy that inspired me with awestruck admiration. And this is the key sentence coming up. The key sentence is, they were always done in pencil, and then inked in sepia, and brush washed with color in the winter evenings. Now, the diary bears this out, and almost whenever he penned it, he called it penning in, he penned in over the pencil lines, usually with a full bottle of Marsala in front of him. But he didn't do all of them. Some of these he kept, and what Congreve suggests is that he brought them back to London, and he finished them in London. So the lines may have been put on top of the pencil lines in Malta. The colors may have been added back in London in a studio arrangement with good lighting and a flat surface and so forth. This partly explains what I find to be the marvelous quality in his work between a very fine but assured and a line of conviction and the seeming spontaneity of the brushwork. He wasn't doing them all at once, and it should make it clear, Lear was not a watercolor painter like J.M.W. Turner was a watercolor painter. Turner painted with the brush. Lear did not paint with the brush. Lear did everything in pencil line. He's a linearist. He's part of that great Florentine Renaissance tradition of seeing line as the primary descriptive element in a work of art, color being secondary. And this comes from a tradition of English topographical work, which are frequently called, I think probably correctly, not even true watercolors, but tinted drawings. Lear's work, at least these preliminary studies that he makes, are tinted drawings. And here you have one from the, it's in the exhibition. They're different sizes, as I mentioned, and when you check the diary for the weather conditions of the day, that explains the different sizes of the watercolors. How simple could that be? When he's at Civitavecchia on the 1st of February, pure paradise weather, no wind, work large. When he's in Gozo, the wind was too terrible and I could do little. The watercolors become very small. So if you see a Lear watercolor, you can virtually tell what the atmospheric conditions were like at the time. Now, all of the on-site sketches were created by him as preparatory works for either more fully worked up and detailed descriptive watercolors that he would paint in the studio, or in his hopeful mind, which seldom occurred, but in his hopeful mind, oil paintings. And he would use these sketches with all their color notes and so forth as the basis of the studio watercolor. Now, this one of Benjema is in the exhibition, and it's obviously based on number 82 and number 83, which were painted on site. I've lost track of number 83, last saw it in 1947 when it was published in black and white in a popular American magazine, of all things. If anybody has ever seen a watercolor numbered 83, you know, tell me about it, buy it, if you can. So you can see kind of the difference here that we're talking about, the sketchiness, the suggestiveness of the preparatory study, the plein air study, the freshness of it. You really sense the spontaneity of it. There you use the word impression of it. Lear had nothing to do with the impressionists, but there is something in his aesthetic which responds to impressions. When he does the studio watercolors, they're more detailed, they're more descriptive, there's more incident in it, any square inch of the watercolor on the right compared to any square inch of the watercolor on the left will show more detail. And to the modern eye, and to my eye, I have to confess, I find the spontaneity of the preliminary sketches preferable to what sometimes seems like an overworked, a little bit laborious treatment of the final version. And you can see comparisons like this will survive. 115, which is in the exhibition, and one of the watercolors that followed from it at the Fitzwilliam Museum. And no difference in dimensions. Some of the finished studio watercolors are quite a bit smaller. And he did them in a series. He did some watercolors, finished studio watercolors, that are larger and have a bit of the expression and the freshness of the early ones. There are others that seem a bit denser, quite a bit denser, smaller, a little bit more overworked, as if you took a large image and compressed it somehow on the screen. But you notice the difference in size when 10 by 20. When you see something that's 10 by 20, or roughly those dimensions by Lear, these are works that form part of a series of watercolors that he made while in Malta, 26 to be exact. He planned on 30, but he got a bit exasperated with the project. He lowered it to 28. Finally, he finished 26 of these smaller watercolors. Yeah, I mean, here's the description again of when he was at the site. This is the finished watercolor of Salmon, finished the last two small drawings, intended to have been the 5-pound series. Now, this is important, but why does he care about lowering the price of his watercolors? In a letter that he wrote in 1863, 12, 13 years earlier, he says, "Photographs are all the rage now. Photography in Malta cut into the market, such as it was, for watercolors. And to compete with photographers, and Reverend Calvert Jones was in Malta photographing these beautiful salt prints, I believe, around 1850. James Robertson was here showing you the whole Grand Harbor. And these would sell for very little, comparatively very little. And it was undercutting the market. And by the way, lithography began around the same time too. Michele Belanti was making lithographs that sold for £1 each. Lear was trying to, in a sense, mass produce some of these views, but he could not lower his price below £5 for these studio works. And interestingly, from Corfu in the previous century, he said in a letter to his sister, "I have just purchased a photographic machine and hope before long it will be of great service to me in copying plants and many things with which distance, limited time, heat, etc. would prevent my getting. We shall see." Well, we do see, because a year later, Lear sold the photographic equipment to his upstairs neighbor. End of story with Lear and photography. Now, he doesn't mean he didn't look at photographs. The account books, once again, show us here, the 7th of March, he bought photographs for £1.20. There are a couple of references throughout his diary, both in Malta and other places, of him purchasing photographs. And in letters, he will sometimes mention the photographer by name. He does not do that in Malta, but as Judge Bonello can tell you and is amply illustrated in his own publications, there's a lot of photography going on here at the time. Some very significant people are working at it. Now, what did he do with these little small watercolors, which he referred to somewhat disparagingly, I think, as the tyrants? And beginning in 63, when he was back in Corfu, he began producing sets of these small studio works that he referred to as the tyrants. So I think on one occasion he refers to them as the pot boilers, talking of his own work. What he did with them, this is appended to a letter that Lear wrote to an English patron from Corfu in 1863. The bottom of the letter, appended, is a view of the section of the two long walls in the room he used there as a gallery and one of the short walls. And you can see all these pictures just jammed up against each other, frame to frame, in rows of three. And then below, there is, of course, a key to what the number of each one represents. Now, if you ever look at a Lear watercolor, people are often puzzled. If you turn it over and you look at the back, there's another numbering system that you sometimes see. And what do those numbers mean? What those numbers mean is reference to the hanging location. So if he does the show in Corfu in 63, and let's say nothing sells, some did sell in Corfu, but if nothing sold, he could take it all down and reassemble the exhibition based on these little sketches of what went where, what was juxtaposed to what site level each of them would be at. And thus, this little drawing, which we looked at at the beginning from early time in the diary, shows what he does in this gallery. Meantime, I rented out the large room, set the showroom in order, then came, good luck, how they did come from 12 to 6. About 50 people in all, with what I hate, no end of dogs, but no one asked the price, no one even asked the price of a drawing. Lear's success in his enjoyment of Malta was seriously compromised by his ability to sell his work. He didn't go to these places on holiday. He went to these places to work and to sell the work and to live off the proceeds from the work. And if you look at the account books, you can see what they sold for cumulatively in every month, what his expenses were, what his income was. If he doesn't sell watercolors in Corfu or in Malta, he's not going to stay for very long. Now, many of the places he went in the winter months were also frequented by upper-class Brits who would be on a kind of winter sojourn, and they would be, you know, ladies and gentlemen of leisure who had some pocket money to spend and who would buy a watercolor just on a whim. In Malta, that was not the case. In Malta, and you can see from all those dinner table diagrams, with one exception, everyone who he ever had dinner with, who assumed was part of the circle with which he interacted, were British military officers, not part of the collector class at all. I don't think he sold a single watercolor to one of the British naval officers. So I've always wondered, well, why didn't he reach out a bit more and try to contact Maltese people who were themselves collecting other works by Maltese artists and by foreign artists? He does not seem to have made that effort. So here are four more in the exhibition. A couple of these, the ones on the, well, this one, and this one, are somewhat larger and I think are very, very fine works. And of course it's this one, which is on the cover of the book. There's one or two, look at the dimensions, 9.7 by 20 is equal to 15, 17, 17, which are obviously one of the tyrants. So these studio watercolors, every one of these pictures was painted in the studio, not on the site. Some of the ones he really gave more special attention to, they tend to be larger, maybe a little more ambitious, and they're finer. The ones like St. Paul's Bay, PCM, by the way, means Private Collection Malta, and some of them are from the Museum of Fine Arts, and so designated as well. You can see, although this is one area where there's no absolutely categorical distinctions between the tyrants, the potboilers on the one hand, and the complete finished watercolors, larger format on the other hand. And that's the one unanswered question in Lear study, to my mind, the one unanswered question in Lear studies. Now, his most productive period came as we get into the new year, into the month of March, when he spent 10 days in Gozo. He absolutely loved Gozo. Easy to understand why. My visit to Gozo was the most pleasant one. I drew every bit of it, walking 15 to 20 miles a day. Think about that, on the roads, you know, unpaved roads, clunky hiking boots, and so forth. It's coast scenery, and this is where that expression, which is so often repeated in Malta, comes from. It's coast scenery. They truly be called Pumpskilius and Gromphoriborous, being as no words can describe its magnificence. Lear, as you may know, is very fond of neologisms, making up words that have kind of onomatopoetic quality to them. This, by the way, is one of the things that makes transcribing the diary difficult, because sometimes they're made-up words. And when he's talking about something personal, he will, in the diary, write it in Greek. His Greek was pretty good, classic Greek. His Italian was excellent. He would write it in Greek. And I took photocopies of everything he wrote in his diary in Greek. I brought them to a translation center which specializes in doing this kind of work. They sat on this material for 3 weeks. I called them up and I said, what's happened to my translation? And they said, well, we've sent it to two translators who are Greek natives, Greek speakers, and so forth, neither of whom could figure it out. And they said, you want us to send it to a third Greek translator? I said, okay, send it to a third Greek translator, but be sure to tell them it may be nonsense words, not real words, but neologisms that Lear made up. And they said, oh, you didn't tell us that. So then it came back, and I had some things where the Greek word, the letters were transcribed into English, but it made no sense. Now, Lear wrote so many limericks and poems. The only piece of verse that he wrote about Malta turned out to be about Gozo, and he didn't write it while he was on residence here. He wrote it 12 days after his departure on the 22nd of April, and some of you may know this poem, you know, Gozo, my child, was the Isle of Calypso, that naughty young woman who made ex Calypso, and so on. I mean, this is nonsense poetry. It shows another side of Lear's mind, which I think is a bit bifurcated. And in Gozo, he did some of the most beautiful watercolors of all. They tend to be somewhat smaller because it's so windy there. He was in protected places like this cove and over at Rabat. I thought this was in the exhibition. It's not. There's one very close to it in the exhibition, and number 200 is in the exhibition. These are really, I think, very beautiful works. And by the way, after he was in Malta for a while, he learned about different paper products that were for sale on the island. Some of the earliest watercolors of Malta by Lear, some of which we've looked at, which were not included in the exhibition, were not included because he was using paper made from wood pulp. And there was a lot of oxidation and color change and darkening. And it was really not Lear's fault particularly, but maybe it was. He didn't pay enough attention to the kind of paper he was buying. After he's been here a while, he got better paper, which is not Foss to that extent. One of my favorite ones is this. I've long ago given up trying to pronounce Maltese names, so I'm not going to pronounce the name of this place. It's number 231 in the private collection, and it shows the variety. And some of these are body color added to watercolor. And so when you get certain opaque passages like this and this, this is white paint laid on top of watercolor paint. And of course you have the inscription here and so forth. And some of them have those color notes, notations, and so on. Now, if anyone can tell me where this painting is, I would be eternally grateful. Lear painted one oil painting of Malta. And I don't mean in Malta, but I mean of Malta, painted after he left the island. There's no record in his diary that he ever painted this picture while he was here. And one of his favorite places in Gozo was Ta Chench, and he went there repeatedly. He referred to it. He made little drawings, sketches in the margin of letters and diary and so forth. He made one oil painting, which he sold to a Mr. Charles Roundell, who passed away around the turn of the 20th century. His widow still possessed it in 1911. We know of this only from this black and white illustration, which is in the later letters of Edward Lear, published in that year. Current whereabouts unknown. Love to know where it is, love to see it in color. It was probably his favorite spot in Gozo. Now, his attitudes towards Malta in Gozo, as I think I mentioned, were heavily covered by the sales that he didn't make. He says back in 1848, one of his earliest trips, I could not live at Malta. There's hardly a bit of green in the whole island, a hot sandstone. This is April, mind you, it was getting closer to summer. Hot sandstone, bright white houses are all you can see from the highest places, excepting stupid little trees here and there, like rubbishy tufts of black worsted. The harbors are very interesting, but I don't love water well enough to be always boating, nor can I draw ships well enough to portray such scenes characteristically. The street scenery, so white, so bright, so clean, so balconied, is really beautiful, but there the charm ends. Well, in fact, he did quite a few paintings of boats when he was in Gozo. Nearly all of them, I think with one exception, by quite a few, I mean 8 or 10, with one exception are all in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, who collects anything with boats in it, of course. And those works were acquired, of course, after Lear's death. And then, you know, notes appear in letters and diaries. This is the later trip we have more documentation for. The propinquity of the noisy sea and the high wind oppressed me abundantly. These things, and Mr. Edwards, who had commissioned the painting back in London, but had never paid for it, and he's constantly griping and grousing, Edwards doesn't send me the check. I really need this money. That's with flies and a pain in my toe, all affects me at once. Bother. When he's annoyed, he ends the sentence frequently with the word bother. And so the image you get from the text that accompanies his visit here could be very cranky, cantankerous, irritable, and so forth. The joy of the watercolors, I think, speaks for itself. We don't need to apologize for the pleasure we take in looking at some of those works. But I want to end this talk, I've got about 5 minutes, to introduce a part of Lear that is not so well known, that I've culled together from all of the letters and the marginalia from all of the poetry and marginalia from the diary. Here's another line. My whole winter gain, 25 pounds, must remain a melancholical reminiscence of the Rocky Island and its swell community. I think here above he's complaining about these military people. They all came to look at his beautiful drawings and never bought anything. I am perfectly ashamed of Malta. You know, this is the irritability of Malta, and I do not want to leave you with that impression. In the marginal notes, and I was very pleased to see in the exhibition for the large label, introductory label, is a reproduction of something from his previous journey, 1862, where he, at the end of the letter, he draws this little caricature of himself and general appearance, distinguished landscape painter, his hair having grown to a violent excess of length. And there are quite a few of these works. Some of them made in Malta itself. He's here a little more than a month. He gets a terrible head cold. And in the diary, he draws this. I am not well, a cold in the head and a swollen nose. And this is when he's here. And he shows himself characteristically looking like a seagull. This is what Lear really looked like. He was portly, perhaps, not fat, not certainly not obese. He had this long beard. He had a receding hairline. These two photos were taken right about the time he was in Malta, 65, 66, and they're dated. I didn't put the dates on. He was a bit of a dandy. He loves three-piece checkered suits. He either owned three or four of them, or he only owned one, and he wore it every single time his picture was taken. And this one, he's got the little wire spectacles and the bushy beard. This is, of course, a studio setup. That's what he looked like. But throughout these self-images, these self-caricatures, he shows himself as a very portly individual, very small feet, spindly legs, the bushy beard, the spectacles, and these go on really through his whole career. And they may or may not be related to the taste for caricature political satire that originated in France during the era of Louis Philippe, who is often shown as a pear. And so you see the metamorphosis of Louis Philippe turning into a pear. Maybe that stands behind, maybe that nurtured Lear's own ideas about caricature. But the one thing to be clear is that there's no political significance to any of Lear's drawings or caricature. It would be anachronistic to suggest there was. Some of the complaints that we find in the diary are also played out in some. This Lear goes out, how the wind is inconveniently high. His hat's blowing off, his spectacles are blowing off, the trees are bent over. This is, in a way, a picture of his own frustration of working out of doors as an artist, especially in Malta. This, of course, is not done in Malta. Many of his self-caricatures portray him in a state of movement of some sort. As I say, he's peripatetic. He was never really satisfied to be in one place. I think he was probably being chased by demons, internal demons, but we don't want to try to psychoanalyze somebody from a previous century. He's flying through the air. He's riding a fish. Looks like a happy fish. Here he's carrying his luggage. Here he's in Palmyra on the back of a camel. He hated camels, but he traveled by camel. And here's a skeleton of death spearing him from behind. Here he had some happy days in India, and he's riding an elephant in India. There's Lear. There's the servant holding the umbrella. There's Giorgio Kankali holding his drawing instruments. And this marvelous drawing, which is in the Morgan Library in New York, is from a slightly earlier date, and it shows Lear's sort of self-caricature of his traveling kit. And I'm not going to belabor the point by going through everything that he carried with him, but here he is lying in bed, flat stomach this time, and at the foot of the bed is piled up all of these things, a bureau and a table and a chair. But I draw your attention to number 11, which is the sparkling looking glass. It's an optical device that he used in the earlier period, which we then replaced with that single monocular lens in the later period. And Lear, I want to leave the idea that he could be a very playful chap if his personal relationships all basically ended in failure. Lear's best friend was his cat, Foss. And he portrayed this just two examples. I could show you a dozen examples of Foss alone, Lear with Foss at the age of 7, 3 and a half, with Foss at the age of 16, and Foss was his inseparable companion. And the one thing, as a postscript to this talk, which I can't sort of resist saying, there is a deep real kinship, I suppose, affinity, if you will, between that other great writer of nonsense in the 19th century, Lewis Carroll. This is what they have in common. They both suffered from epilepsy and obsessive compulsive disorder. They never married, but they loved children. They moved between the rational and the whimsical at ease, and they wrote nonsense poems under a pseudonym. Here's Lewis Carroll. His real name is Charles Dodson. He was trained as a mathematician, and he wrote a treatise on geometry, which has just in the last year or two been reprinted. I'm not somebody who knows anything about geometry. I can't vouch for its importance in the history of the literature on geometry, but it has been reprinted within a couple of years ago. And this is the book on Euclid, modern, and you can see Charles Dodson. Earlier, 1865, at the same time Lear was here, you have Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. When you look at Lear, the first printed edition of his Book of Nonsense, it's authored by Derry Down Derry. Who's Derry Down Derry? That's just a made-up nonsense name. It's that this book went into later editions. He substituted Derry's name with his own name over here, Edward Lear. So I think it's this kind of kinship between Lear and Lewis Carroll, sort of two different identities within one brain, the rational, the irrational, the whimsical, and so on. And so the last image I'd like to show you is one that sort of combines these two facts. I doubt if the day that Lear walked to Fomari from Medina, he was kicking up his heels in delight when he was there. But when he sees himself independent of the task at hand, he'd be really quite lighthearted and frivolous. So this is Lear, a complicated man, to be sure. I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone had any. Thank you. Yes.
I think I might have misunderstood you when you said Turner used a brush and Lear didn't.
Well, I think Turner in his earlier phase did drawing, but the Turner that he evolved into Turner with a capital T is strictly painterly.
So Lear still applied his watercolors with a brush of some kind?
Only after he did the underdrawing.
Indeed.
Every single one of his on-site drawings begins with an underdrawing in pencil, which goes over it in ink, and then the color is an overlay done at some later point. We don't always know precisely when. Some Lear drawings, by the way, and my wife and I happen to own a Lear drawing, which he did in Sicily, is dated in two different periods. It was done in Sicily, and one says where he was, the site in Sicily, 1842. On the other side of the sheet, in his own hand, autograph hand, it says 1844. And I think I was puzzled by that until I realized he did the drawing in 1842, and then he added the color in 1844. So there's some fluidity in the creative dates of this. And indeed, some of these watercolors will actually say that. It will have two dates on it. It may say February 15th, March 15th. Now, it could be the light was growing bad. We know from the diary he was caught in several torrential rainstorms and wouldn't have completed something, may have gone back to it or reimagined it. There's a little bit of confusion sometimes there.
First of all, thank you for a really wonderful talk. He really was a man of opposites. On the one hand, he's riddled with health problems, and then he was able to cover such long distances.
Right.
Clearly, he must have suffered from patches of depression, but then he had this extraordinary sense of humor.
Right.
And the other opposite, which I think is quite intriguing, is that he was ever so painstaking and meticulous in recording everything, and yet his works have this minimalist spontaneity. It's as though it was the only route where he could just let go. And illustration, this where he's being frivolous and acting like a child.
Right.
I feel it's very much expressed in his works. I very much agree with your observation, where his on-site work has this fresh quality. There's a sense of spirit in them more than the studio works, which obviously he had time to apply more of his, and perhaps would have risked switching into his more meticulous mode,
right,
which he would have done, you know,
right,
when recording his in his diaries. A final point I'd like to make, with regards to the view of St. Julian's Bay, the time was 5:15 p.m., mm-hmm, December, Malta.
Right.
I found it a little bit too bright for the time. I mean, if you all agree, it's usually almost dark by then. So what you've just mentioned, this fluidity, this
right,
little bit of imagination, I mean, of course, we're not expecting him, because of the works he has produced, to be correct even in the light conditions or weather conditions. But then on the other hand, he would go so far as to put in, mm-hmm, this particular detail of time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, very good observations. Thank you. And Berndine was one of the persons that gave the approval of the loan of five beautiful watercolors in the Museum of Fine Arts, so we're very grateful to you for that effort. In terms of the dates, the times of day, I suspect it was the time he completed the watercolor or the drawing, which he may have begun earlier. On the other hand, there is a sequence of watercolors at the Yale Center for British Art that he made in Egypt, of one site in Egypt, and they're sequentially dated 15 minutes apart. And that, I would assume, is the amount, and they're from different locations. There's one monument seen from different perspectives, 15 minutes apart. And obviously the color took more time later on, but he could work fairly quickly. I'm not saying he did every watercolor in every underdrawing in 15 minutes, but he was capable of turning out some of these works in 15 minutes. There are no sequences like that of the Maltese watercolors. I suspect you're right. He probably started at 4 in the afternoon, and who knows, you know. Yes?
On a lesser note,
his tummy and the pain in his toe indicates he had gout too.
Lear was a hypochondriac, and it's really, it's never been clear to me, I mean, how can you analyze a medical condition of somebody who died in 1888? I mean, retrospectively, you can look at some images, and there are doctors in the field that have a program called Art Medicine, in which they apply modern diagnostic methods to old paintings, and can talk about various diseases that somebody in the 16th century portrait might be suffering from. But yeah, gout, but would he have known it was gout? One of the things I looked for very carefully was any sign of medications that he purchased. Because he records every other purchase, I would love to have known what he was taking for epilepsy, especially, or any of these other ailments, you know, breath inhalers or so forth. Nothing turns up in the account books for any medicinal or pharmacological remedy. That was the secret. That in his truly personal life, his gender orientation, if you will, is not something that is recorded. But he's a Victorian, after all. He's not like us who are out there all the time. He was very, very enclosed. Yes?
The impression that there was colored paper.
It was toned paper. Often it was toned paper. Yeah, so he'd work from dark to light with dark ground. I haven't actually gone through them all with that idea in mind, but I think you might be able to detect that. He uses different kinds of paper. One of the things that really interests me is that they're all such different sizes. I mean, there are no two Lear watercolors that are identical size. So he must have, you know, just snipped things out and scraps. And there are some scraps. He only painted two works that appear to us today in the vertical format as opposed to the horizontal format, the rectangular format. One of them is an exhibition of the Busquets Gardens. That was cut down. That began as a horizontal painting. It was cut down. Somewhere in the world, maybe the other half of that drawing is seen. So the verticality of that composition is completely atypical. And, you know, Lear's known as the Lord of the Horizon, always begins with a firm horizon line. And then I think in the February talk, I discussed directionality in his works. This is a pronounced directionality from left to right, rising diagonal from left to right. And certain scenes, places where he went, had that as their intrinsic properties in nature. Yesterday we were at Benjema, and he drew Benjema and painted in the exhibition one of the studio watercolors, total of about 5 or 6 times. Why Benjema? Benjema has a natural landscape in place which corresponds so beautifully to Lear's own semiotic vision of the movement of eye across a page. I think in Benjema, Lear found his place where the actual landscape coincided with his view of what a landscape should be and how to represent it.
Thank you once again, John. It's a real education to listen to you. Again, I keep learning so much from you, and hopefully we'll be able to pass on this knowledge to our visitors at the exhibition. The exhibition is currently open, so this would be the best time to go and see it after we've been primed with all this information. There is a little donation that we ask people to give to visit the exhibition, and I hope you understand that this is necessary in order to present more and more exhibitions to you in future. Thank you very much. Thank you, John.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falzone Historic House Museum entitled Edward Lear, The Exhibition. This talk was delivered by Professor John Variano.
Wieħed mill-bini li nbenefiz minn il-kavalieri tal-Ordni ta' San Juan kien it-Teatru Manuel. Kien il-Grammastru Antonio Manuel de Villena, li fis-seklu 18 ħaħsib li offri kemm għall-kavalieri kif ukoll għall-istess pubbliku Malti l-opportunità biex jiddeverti f'post mibni apposta għal dan il-għan. Kien dan il-Grammastru li xtara żewġ id-djar u bekk ta' bidu għall-bini tat-teatru. Tqabbad il-perit tal-Ordni Romano Carapecchia u dan jidher li ma tantx ħaw wis żmien biex jiddiżinja teatru. Minħabba li l-art li kellu fejn seta jibni it-teatru kienet ristretta, Carapecchia ħaħsib biex jibni faċċata li tmur ma l-istess ambjent tal-inħawi. Iżda t-teatru minn ġewwa jkollu dak kollu li wieħed kien jistenna. Minħabba d-dislivel ta' triq, il-bini xorta waħda huwa bilanċat sew. Bib ċentrali u żewġ bibin żgħar, wieħed fuq kull naħa jagħmlu dekorazzjoni tal-istess faċċata. Iż-żewġ solari li hemm għandhom twieq ikbar u twieq iżgħar fis-solar ta' fuq nett. U hekk kif wieħed iħares lejn din il-faċċata naturalment wieħed jonqos li jifhem x'jista' jkun hemm fuq wara. It-teatru nbena fis-sena 1731 u dan prattikament jidher li kien lest fi żmien 10 xhur biss. Il-perit Carapecchia ħaħsib li fuq ġewwa jkun hemm teatru mibni bil-kumditajiet kollha. Faċċata tal-palk poġġiet il-gallerija prinċipali dik tal-Grammastru. Mal-ġemp kien hemm aktar gallariji jew kaxxi maħsuba l-mistiedna speċjali. Kien hemm post tal-paġġi wkoll. Iżda dan ma kienx biżejjed. F'dak is-sular kien hemm 10 kaxxi barra dik tal-Grammastru. Fis-sular ta' fuq kien hemm 13-il kaxxa. Fil-waqt li fuq nett imbagħad kien hemm biss 5 kaxxi. Iżda post bħal bankijiet għal aktar udjenza. Dawna tpoġġew ħdejn dawna l-ħames kaxxi. Il-plateja kellha 14,000 fil-lira fesiqtaw joqogħdu aktar nies. L-istess Carapecchia ħaseb ukoll ħalli fit-teatru jkun hemm kmamar żgħar fejn dawk li jattendu għas-serati jkunu jistgħu jaqdu l-bżonnijiet naturali tagħhom. Kien hemm kmamar imdaqsa kemm għall-atturi kif ukoll għall-bżonnijiet oħra li jkunu mistennija li wieħed jara f'teatru. L-ewwel serata nżammet f'Jannar tas-sena 1732 għalkemm għadda minn diversi tibdil u arranġamenti matul is-sekli dan it-teatru huwa wieħed mill-eqdem li nsibu fl-Ewropa. Campus FM. Matul is-sekli fil-Gżejjer Maltin waslu fostna diversi personalitajiet differenti. Min wasal f'Malta bil-moħbi u brava jisra u jkisser, min wasal fostna bil-barka ta' min kien imexxi u ġie rispettat. Uħud minn mistednin kienu ta' ċertu kalibru akademiku. U fostna niltaqgħu ma' wieħed Ġermaniż bl-isem ta' Athanasius Kircher. Dan kien patri Ġeżwita u kien meqjum bħala wieħed mill-aktar nies orrif li kienu jgħixu f'dak iż-żmien. Il-preżenza tiegħu f'Malta tidher li kienet mixtieqa mill-istess awtoritajiet tal-ordni. Minħabba li kienu għamlu talba lill-ġenerali tal-Ġiżwiti biex jibgħat li xi ħadd ħalli jgħallem il-matematika. Jidher li xewqa kienet li jintbaq xi ħadd ta' ċertu kalibru, ħalli bekk il-kulleġġ tal-istudji fil-Belt Valletta jkun ukoll infaħħar. Għalkemm il-permess ingħata, meta ġie biex jintaqsa persuna kien hemm il-bżonn li jkun xi ħadd ta' ċertu livell anke rigward ir-reliġjon. U dan minħabba li kien hemm kavallir Ġermaniż li kien għadu kemm ikkonverta u riet li jidħol ukoll bħala membru tal-Ordni ta' San Juan. Għal daqstant, il-Kurja Rumana batet li l-Kirxa biex jakkumpanja li dan il-kavallir sażuħ. Zdaftit wara l-wasla tiegħu f'Malta, dan il-Ġiżwita għaref mill-ewwel beda jinduna bin-noqqasijiet li kienu f'Malta. Huwa kiteb lura lejn Ruma u talab li jingħata l-permess li jirritorna lejn Ruma immedjatament. Għalkemm Kirxa ma tantx dam f'Malta, huwa laħaq ħadem, studja u anki jagħmel xi żjarat u ħbieb ukoll. Iltaqa' ma' Giovanni Francesco Abela. Kif ukoll ma' Giovanni Francesco Bonamico u Domenico Magri. Matul iż-żmien li Athanasius Kircher għamel f'Malta, nafu li huwa kien mar iżur il-palazz tal-Verdara. Kien waqt din iż-żjara li tieħed jara l-komunità ta' Maltin li kienu għadhom jgħixu far il-kbir. Fil-fatt meta Kircher irritorna lura Ruma, huwa kien kiteb diversi trattati u fosthom hemm wieħed li jitkellem u jiddeskrivi din il-komunità ta' Maltin. Skont informazzjoni tiegħu, huwa kien żar ukoll Għawdex fejn kien ittieħed iżur komunità oħra li kienet tgħix simili għal dik ta' Rigby. Minn din l-informazzjoni li Kircher tagħna nafu għalhekk b'ċertu dettalji li wieħed ma kienx jista' jsibhom x'imkien ieħor. Athanasius Kircher tellaq minn Malta fi frar tas-sena 1638. Għalkemm irritorna lejn Ruma mingħajr qatt ma reġa' ġi Malta, xorta waħda żamm kuntatt ma' uħud mill-personaġġi li huwa stess kien iltaqa' meta kien f'Malta.
Campus FM.
Waħda mill-knejjes iż-żgħar li nsibu fir-Raba ta' Għawdex hija dik li hemm ftit l-isfel mill-misraħ, magħruf aħjar bħala t-tokk. Din il-knisja żgħira għalkemm tkun miftuħa kuljum, forsi ftit jafu biha l-Maltin li jitilgħu jżuru r-Rabat għax mhijiex fl-inħawi fejn wieħed jassoċja mal-passiġġata fejn imorru l-biċċa kbira tal-Maltin. Din il-knisja hija aktar magħrufa bħala ta' Savina, inkella ta' Savina. Biss il-knisja hija ddedikata lit-twelit tal-Madonna. Bħal knisja oħra li hemm fl-inħawi dik ta' San Ġagbu, din il-knisja kienet tinstab oriġinarjament aktar viċin iċ-ċittadella. L-oriġini tagħha iżda huwa mitluf fl-istorja. Hawnhekk tajjeb li jingħad li ħafna mid-dokumentazzjoni ta' żmien medjovali ta' Għawdex huwa mitluf. Minħabba f'hekk ftit hija l-informazzjoni li tkun magħrufa. Waqt ċol ta' skavar li sar biex tinbena l-knisja preżenti instabu wkoll f'dalijiet ta' oqbra Musulmani u hemm imniżel ukoll li kien hemm lapita ta' fuq il-qabar. Din l-istess lapita tieħdet lejn il-Mużew tal-Belt kif kien isir f'dak iż-żmien. Min jaf jekk kienx hemm ximiterju Musulman f'dak l-inħawi. Għalkemm mhuwiex magħruf jekk kienx hemm knisja qabel iżda. Huwa magħruf li fis-sena 1479 kien hemm diġà knisja. Sas-sena 1551 kienet għadha tiffunzjona sew, iżda f'dik is-sena spiċċat imkissra u mfarka wara l-inżul tal-pirati Musulmani. Għamlet żmien abbandonata. Iżda lejn il-bidu tas-seklu 17 inbniet minn ġdid u din saret fuq inizjattiva ta' Giovanni Pietro Formosa. Fis-sena 1622 it-titular kien ġie moti bħala rigal mill-Gvernatur ta' Għawdex u dan huwa l-istess kwadru li għadu fuq l-altar ta' knisja sal-ġunata tal-lum. L-Knisja preżenti bdiet tinbena fl-għamla tagħha fil-bidu tas-seklu 20. Fil-fatt, fis-sena 1904, il-Kardinal Ferrata, waqt li kien qiegħed għal żjara f'pajjiżna, kien ħa sem waqt il-funzjoni tal-ftuħ tagħha. Minħabba li mill-ewwel bdiet tiżdied l-attendenza f'din il-Knisja, fis-sena 1913 tkabbret. Anzi, minn dak iż-żmien il-qoddim il-Knisja nfetħet għall-adorazzjoni perpetwa. Il-Knisja hija sempliċi fl-għamla arkitettonika tagħha. Hija mibnija fuq l-istil klassiku fejn hemm il-pilastri, iżda neqsin minn kull dekorazzjoni bħalma wieħed huwa mdorri jara fil-faċċati tal-knejjes Maltin. Għandna numru ta' taraġġ quddiema minħabba li tinsab f'parti mitriq li hemm dislivel. Bib ċentrali mpoġġi bejn erba' pilastri. Fil-parti ta' fuq tal-faċċata hemm niċċa fin-nofs fejn hemm statwa li turi l-Ġesu li qed iżomm kalċi fideh. Ir-raġuni li tpoġġi din l-istatwa hija minħabba li l-knisja saret fejn ukoll hemm espost is-sagrament.